The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Sometimes there's a podcast. Well, there's a podcast for its time and place. A podcast that fits right in there. And that's Zach on Film, talking about The Big Lebowski.
Okay.
That's what I came up with.
Not quite Sam Elliott. But,
no, not even close. Didn't even want to try.
Man, I love Sam Elliott's voice. I wish I had...
You gotta get real low on the back of your throat.
I can't. I don't have a... Even imagine what it would feel like to grow a mustache like that. And so I don't want to tarnish
that man's
image.
That's what causes the voice. If he shaves,
he sounds like this.
But with that mustache, he gets a little resonance and he gets kind of an echo chamber effect.
Yeah, if there was just...
What's for dinner.
I know that people are not big fans of that twang country accent. But man, if I could just have somebody do intros for our shows, you know, like this time on the Major Spoilers podcast, we'll be talking about, or our shout outs, you know, no offense, Matthew, but if I could have, you know, a professional voice actor do shout outs and stuff, Sam Elliott would be a perfect person to just say this week's episode of the Major Spoilers podcast.
Having been repeatedly paid for my voice work, Mr. Smarty Pants, I will remind you that I am a professional voice actor.
So
that said, I would also hire Sam Elliott.
If Sam Elliott started doing intros for our shows, I would honor that by always wearing a leather vest to every recording session.
And a big old Stetson.
And a big cowboy hat.
And a big old cowboy hat. With a nice bottle of sarsaparilla every time we record.
I'd wear a cowboy hat and probably do an impression of Jim Ross.
Man, we're like 5 minutes into the show talking about Sam Elliott, and we're really
and we're
here talking
about the opening narration.
Welcome to the Sam Elliott Show.
Oh, man, Sam Elliott.
The Big Sambowski.
So, The Big Lebowski. Zach, what do we know about this movie?
We know that it was made by the Coen brothers.
Okay,
that's all. Released in 98. Seven, eight.
Something like that.
Yep, one of those years.
98.
And that is what we know about it. It is well-loved. It is classified as a cult film.
Yes.
And I do not believe it is in that hallowed library of...
No, it's not.
Movies,
but here's why I put it on the list, is that it takes movies that we've talked about before, like The Maltese Falcon... And I don't know if we have it on the list. Maltese Falcon and not Dial M for Murder, although that could work as well. But I'm thinking of...
the other one?
Yeah, the other one with Humphrey Bogart, the other Raymond Chandler. No,
the other Sam Spade
movie. The other Sam Spade movie.
I don't know.
And I think this extrapolates this and puts it into modern times. And turns it more into a comedy, though it's not a parody of those films.
No.
But it's saying, what if you just had this average, ordinary person, this dude, who had to go through all the tropes of a Chandler novel without being a true detective, even though there's a series on HBO about that. And what would happen? What would happen with that?
Sure.
So that's kind of why this is on here. Plus, it's a Coen Brothers film, and we don't have too many Coen Brother movies on here, including Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which really should be.
Yeah, there's a couple different plot, I guess you would kind of say formulas, thrown in this movie, which once you figure out it is really none of those, that I think is when the movie really becomes something
So give us an example.
Well,
that
so,
out.
So the movie is essentially about this slob, Jeff Lebowski, who gets mixed up for this rich guy whose Playboy bunny wife, Bunny, needs or owes a lot of people money around town. And so they try to compete out of him. So there's like a mistaken identity plot mm-hmm. that goes through this film. And then like a wild goose chase of him trying to do what the big what the Lebowski rich man wants to earn some money. And then it bounces around from person to person to person as he tries to figure out how to solve the situation. When really all he wanted was to get his rug replaced.
Yeah.
But then...
Because it really tied the room together.
Yeah, it really tied the room together. And so you go through two-thirds of the movie over that of this kind of detective case of him trying to find the money and figure out who's lying and who's telling the truth, and pretty much everyone's lying. And then we get to a scene where everything's done, and the crux of the story, the central location of the story essentially has been a bowling alley.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of feel like the movie's winding down. They kind of figured out everyone's lying, everyone's full of crap. Walter drops a paralyzed man on the floor. You get a laugh and you think, well, this movie's kind of done. And then some nihilists return and you're like, well, what you think it's just going to resolve in a funny way? Like, hey, all this money's fake. You guys don't need to do anything. And then that's when the big turn comes in as, so Jeff Lebowski is the main character. Then you have Walter, his crazy friend. And then a third character, Donnie, who mm-hmm. ends up having a heart attack. And the movie turns from this detective case to what the movie is really about is a friendship buddy film between the dude and Walter and how their ideologies clash and how they kind of reconcile and end up being okay with each other is what I felt like the movie was ultimately about, and that they used the situations of the mistaken identity in this wild goose detective case to come all around and really be about these two.
I think
that was the big turn of the movie that really made me like sit back and start thinking about it more.
And I think you may be onto something there. I mean, that's a very interesting take on the film, especially when you consider that Donnie, is that his name? Donnie? Shout out Donnie.
Mm-hmm.
Donnie, yeah.
Steve Buscemi's character. When you see them in the bowling alley, the way that they're normally situated is you've got Lebowski on the left,
mm-hmm.
Walter on the right, usually mm-hmm. framed in there. And that kind of aligns with their ideologies. One that leans far to the left, the other one that leans far to the right. And the person in the middle who kind of balances everything out for them is Donnie.
Yeah.
And when Donnie dies, even though, you know, he's barely in this film, he's kind of what's keeping those two from really blowing up at each other all the time. Even the exchange when they're trying to do the money handoff, Lebowski and Walter are fighting with one another, but they don't really come to arguments about what is the real problem. And the minute that Donnie dies and you're doing that, you're doing the ashes ceremony, which is hysterical.
Really funny.
It just comes to the head of, why do you got to be this way, Walter? Why you got to be this? Why do you got to be this? And ultimately and this often happens in arguments, you have to get out what's really troubling you in order to have the catharsis where you can say, oh, okay, now we're all okay. Now we understand mm-hmm. where we're coming from. And we don't know how much time it passes from that scattering of the ashes scenes to them at the bowling alley. But when you see Lebowski come up at the end with the stranger there, he's in a super great mood. It's like the cares of the world are suddenly gone away from him. So you might be onto something in that interpretation of the movie.
Cool. Yeah, Donnie. So I watched this movie and then I bought it because I usually rent everything from iTunes. I watched it. I bought it. I came back from work and started watching it a little bit again. And Steve Buscemi is freaking amazing. He's so funny because you lose him in the background, especially mm-hmm. in that big scene where you start kind of seeing characters unfold with Walter drawing his piece and pointing mm-hmm. at Smokey.
Mm-hmm.
you lose Donnie in the background. Like, right. I didn't even notice him the first time so forward focused in frame that I always just assumed Donnie wasn't even in frame the first time I watched it. But then I watched it again and he's framed perfectly right in the middle, under Walter's arm almost. Mm-hmm. And you see him and he's just like wigging out and amazing.
Yeah. What do you think of that? What do you think of Zach's read there, Rodrigo?
I think it's totally valid. I think Donnie is kind of this he's kind of this comic relief the whole time. Really, Walter's reaction to him is kind of comic relief throughout
the whole thing.
And then, it does kind of flip in that you see that there's a friendship there that kind of holds them together. I think it's a good, it's definitely a good read.
Thank you. Matthew, what about you? Because you really took me by that.
It's definitely got...
I'm kind of trying to figure out where we're going to go from there, because you kind of hit on something that's very interesting.
Well, and he makes a good point. And what's really impressive is it's the text of the film actually supports him, because what is the most commonly stated thing in this movie? Shut the F up, Donnie. Donnie is like the shock absorber between Walter and the dude.
We're done. Call it. Thanks for watching Zach on Film.
So
see you next time.
We don't talk very much about Coen Brothers, but I think, you know, man, if you're going to be influenced by somebody, Zach, it should be the Coen Brothers. I mean, and the stuff that they do. Have you watched a lot of their films?
No, not really.
Not that Steven has an opinion or anything.
I mean, their stuff is just really good.
Watch this.
Have you seen O Brother, Where Art Thou?
I watched O Brother, Where Art Thou all the time in high school.
What about Blood Simple?
Have you seen Barton Fink?
Fargo, Barton Fink.
No, I haven't seen Fargo. It's on my list.
You haven't seen Fargo?
No.
Good movie.
It's on my instant queue.
Fargo is a great movie.
You know, I think this might be a better movie. They did No Country for Old Men too, didn't they?
Yes.
If they did, I still haven't seen it. I really haven't seen anything.
They did the True Grit remake.
Really Raising Arizona.
Oh, I have seen. They did True Grit?
Yeah, I did see that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They did the remake where the dude was John Wayne.
Which is really crazy. Which is really crazy. You know, you mentioned the actors. I think this is the Coens tend to use actors that they like a lot and ones that they've worked with a lot. John Goodman has been in every Coen Brothers movie. Was he in True Grit? He's usually in every single Coen Brothers movie. Which I find very fascinating.
John Goodman.
I'll check this out.
Fantastic. Like,
yeah, he is.
He is an exceptionally good actor.
Yeah.
He's wonderful here.
Oh no, he is fantastic here, and
especially as somebody that's like totally burned out, you know, probably suffering from some post-traumatic stress syndrome, and also is just so set in his he's set in his beliefs, but I think he's easily influenced.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, look at this. I mean, he switches his religion to Judaism because of his ex-wife, and he was raised Polish Catholic. And it's just like, and then he totally dives into everything about that, even though he isn't following the rules, especially about, you know, the Saturday. No technology. Is that what it is, Matthew? Is it no work at all?
Shomer Shabbos, basically. Right. There's a list of 39 things you can't do.
Right.
They basically break down to melacha, which means that creative acts.
Right.
For lack of a better term. You can't light a fire. You can't put out a fire. You can't plant. You can't plow. You can't reap. There's a lot of different things that you do not do. Technically, depending on how you read it, you're not supposed to carry or transfer yourself between domains, which means technically
you're not supposed to
leaving
walk, drive
the house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you can hire a goyim.
You're definitely
to do
not
all
supposed
that for
to drive.
You. Yeah,
driving would be starting a fire. You definitely can't drive, but technically, you know, it depends on honestly who's doing the thinking. But yeah, you may not, depending on how specific you are about it, be able to leave the room.
And that is
in.
And that is a bit
and
of
and you
a,
certainly can't skin anything.
Yeah, and that's
that
certainly a big
specific,
point
no
of frustration for the dude. And Walter is the religion keeps smacking into this issue, especially when
and Vietnam.
And Vietnam, yes. But the fact that, you know, Walter can't bowl on Saturday, he's not supposed to drive on Saturday, yet the minute that $1 million is involved, he's ready to, you know, break that, rule and go out and do it.
He's good. Ready to roll.
Yep. Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's certainly a thing where he doesn't like the whole Saturday thing, mm-hmm. but I think the dude is more upset that Walter seemingly isn't making this decision for himself or is being influenced from outside sources, where the dude is more like, he's not going to be that, you know?
Yeah, the dude is kind of straightforward in his desire to do nothing.
You know, the dude is actually based on a real life person. There's a great, I think it's up on Vimeo. Yeah. Do a search on Jeffrey Dowd. Or Dodd, I forget how you say his name, but do a search for the real life dude. And there's this great little fascinating documentary. He was part of the Seattle Seven and radical groups of the 60s. And there's this great little documentary and everything that he does. Now, some of it may be somewhat of a setup, but they show him going into the grocery store and literally just drinking White Russians and buying the milk and doing a lot of those things and dressing the same way. Now, again, a lot of that could be for the sake of this documentary. But I think it's very,
from what
very
I read
fascinating.
They take a lot of the Seattle Seven and stuff from it, but they said that he's also, he's involved in like the film business.
Mm-hmm.
And they
said
like he isn't completely lackadaisical. Like when he gets on a project, he will do whatever is her project.
So have you seen this documentary?
No, I was reading. Okay. Analyze of the movie and stuff. They talked about him. Analysis. Yeah. And he said he actually got like punched because he wanted a critic to go watch that thing in Utah.
Yes.
whatever that
Sundance.
Yeah, Sundance. And he wanted this critic to go watch a documentary so bad that he ended up getting punched.
This is Tara Reid's first movie. She was in TV before this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was rather surprising.
She's
to
like
see.
22 in this.
Yeah, is she? I don't know how old she was.
I think 22.
Now,
well, this was 89. She was born in 76. So
there is.
She was 22, 23.
I guess I didn't really pay attention to it this go around, but David Huddleston plays the Big Lebowski in this movie.
Right.
But there is another actor that the Coens have used before. He's white haired, overweight. I think he was in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He usually plays this kind of a Southern kind of smarmy guy. Oh, we saw him. Oh, he played.
That's Charles Durning.
Charles Durning. I think he would have actually been better in this role as the Big Lebowski than David Huddleston, even though he did a fantastic job.
But he's the mayor of Rockridge. Come on.
Well, he's also what is his name in the Muppet movie? He plays the evil Colonel Sanders character.
Well, but that's not Huddleston.
No, that's not Huddleston.
Yeah, that's a different guy.
That's the guy that I say would be a better.
That's Charles Durning.
Yeah, that's Charles Durning. That's who I say would be a better Big
Lebowski. He was Pappy. Pappy O'Daniel's flower.
Yep.
They play similar types though.
Mm-hmm, they do, and that's why you could almost interchange them.
I'm wondering if in 1989, what year did Oh Brother, Where Art Thou come out?
2001 ish.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
I'm wondering if in 1989 Charles Durning wasn't quite old enough to play that kind of role yet. I mean,
98.
Yeah.
98. Well, Charles Durning is actually older than David Huddleston, according to this, and apparently passed away. That sucks. Dang.
I mean, just some great acting in this piece. Everybody has great acting. Even Flea, who plays one of the nihilists, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It's really great is if you imagine that that's Needles.
Yes.
From Back to the Future.
You're a chicken,
that's
McFly.
That's what Needles
you're
becomes.
You're a chicken. A nihilistic chicken.
I cut off your Johnson McFly.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And the big guy.
Is in this as well.
His part was so funny because he had so many great little mannerisms of like when they're going through all the awards of like constantly like kind of stuttering with his words when the dude says something, like readjusting his tie when he feels awkward. Mm-hmm. Or his... So when... The dude comes back to the Lebowski mansion after Bunny has been supposedly kidnapped, and he like bows as he enters the chambers.
Yeah.
It's so freaking funny.
Yeah. What about Julianne Moore?
She's perfect in that role.
What about Julianne Moore?
My God, I love her. This movie, I mean, I've had a crush on Julianne Moore for a while, but this movie, I'm just like, I love that character.
You love the character of Maude, or you love her as an actress?
It's six and one half a dozen in this place, because I think, you know, had that been like Gwyneth Paltrow, the same role would have been off-putting. But the fact that it was Julianne Moore getting up his face and going, some people are afraid of the word vagina.
Yeah.
I know she wasn't German, by the way. I still have German accent.
But she has that very, very
just
harsh dialect and manner of speaking.
That, yeah, that kind of a British accent that doesn't make sense because her father doesn't have one, but I'm okay with that. She probably went to a boarding school.
Well, you can compare Julianne Moore in this movie, and then you compare her in Boogie Nights, and that shows you really kind of the range of what she's capable of doing, which is one extreme to the other.
She's amazing.
And then we get to John Turturro.
It don't matter to Jesus. It don't matter to Jesus.
Yeah, as the
Why
Jesus.
Was that role in this film?
Apparently, Turturro had played another role where he was a Cuban-American pederast in, I think it was a stage play or something. And the Coens were like, oh, yeah, let's just have him do that in this movie, too.
I know he said that he would be up for doing a spinoff
of
his character, but the Coens are like, well, we're not going to direct it. We might write it or whatever. But
Rodrigo, I'm interested in your thoughts of the Jesus.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Why is that character in this movie?
He has no real point.
Because that really can easily be expanded to the rest of the movie. Why does anything that happened in this movie happen in this movie? And the reason is, this is a movie that is about set pieces, right? You have, this movie actually starts three different times, right? It has three different intros to it. You get the
Sam Elliott.
You get Sam Elliott, then you get slow motion bowling set to music, and then you actually get like the like an actual introduction to really the power trio of the movie.
Right.
There are multiple musical, not straight up musical numbers, but multiple pieces set to music that all they really do is kind of jar you out of wherever you thought this movie was going, right? One of them is the Jesus bowling. One of them is any of the times that the dude gets knocked out.
Right.
You kind of get something like that.
A little Busby Berkeley musical.
Right.
So, you know, basically when you think to yourself, what happens in this movie? The actual answer is nothing. Right. Nothing actually happens in this movie. But it is kind of a like this quilt of craziness, and you know, it makes about as much sense for the Jesus to be there and antagonize Walter as it does for, I mean, the nihilists. You know, actually, the nihilists probably make a lot more sense. But like Maude's friend to be there in her study. You know, it's like there's no reason for any of these characters to be involved except for both Lebowski's and Bunny. And Bunny, nobody needs to be there,
right?
That's true.
But they're just interesting.
And I think that's what I really.
I was just going to say they're just kind of interesting characters to throw in.
Yeah, that's kind of what I really like about this. A couple of weeks ago, we had a lot of consternation about the interwebs, about the end of How I Met Your Mother. And I said something to the effect of, real life is a Shaggy Dog story. And there are times in your life where threads seem like they're going to be a story. And then it turns out they're totally not. And people zap in and out of your life and you'll be like, oh, yeah, I used to work with her 16 months ago or something. And it will be something where a person is there and they're really, really important for the 6 weeks that they're in your life, and then they disappear and you literally never see them again. That's what I really kind of enjoyed about this story. It didn't feel like
here's this awesome, you know, noir tale with this character, this hapless character at the middle of it. It's like, here's what happens if you spend a few days with the dude
in Los Angeles with the dude. Yeah.
You know, the movie is as laconic as the main character. And you see that bit with the Jesus, mm-hmm. and there's no reason for him to be there in the context of this story. But if you come back a week later, maybe you see the round robin where they actually go up against him and there's like a really cool story there. Mm-hmm. But we just don't get that because it wasn't part of this portion of dude's life.
Right. And I think that this movie is kind of that way. It's a movie that doesn't really matter. And we'll get to another reason why this is on the list. In fact, you can walk into this movie at any point and follow along from that point forward, even if you've never seen the movie before. And I think, Matthew, you had made a comment earlier that this was the first time that you saw this in the narrative order that it was supposed to be presented in.
Yes, I have seen all of this movie. I have never sat down and watched The Big Lebowski from beginning to end on purpose. I've seen, you know, you'd be watching cable and the first few minutes come on and you go to bed, or you show up and, you know, Tom Boaz is watching it in an afternoon and you see the last half hour. I've seen chunks of this. I've seen it all. But I've never actually watched the movie in actual chronological mm-hmm. order before, mm-hmm. and it's really kind of bizarre. There are scenes in here that I didn't realize were this movie that I thought were another coin.
Yeah. So this movie performed poorly, performed really bad at the box office. Even though it's a Coen Brothers movie, and Coen Brothers have done a lot of really good stuff, they've also done a lot of mediocre stuff, and this certainly would fall into that. Some people, though, say that this is the best Coen Brothers movie ever, and some have put it in their top 10 lists of comedies, top 10 lists of best characters of a certain decade, and it has sparked essentially a cult-like following for this movie. I say not a cult-like following, a cult following for this movie. You've had religions based on Lebowskiism, I think is what it's called. Or Dudism, I'm sorry. Dudism. And they have festivals, Rodrigo.
Did I ever tell you guys?
Yeah, go ahead.
Did I ever tell you guys how I accidentally ended up at Lebowski Fest?
No, please tell us. No. Because it's fascinating.
So, so there's this thing that happens in Louisville, Kentucky called Lebowski Fest. I think that's what it's called. Let me just double check.
It is.
While I'm, at least that's where it started. Nowadays, it might move around a little bit more, but I just happened to be in Louisville the weekend that this was happening, and I was in downtown Louisville walking around with someone, and I just kept seeing these weird people that I thought were homeless. And then I realized that they were all wearing like the same jacket or like the same kind of like, I don't know, like woven sweater.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I realized they were cosplayers cosplaying the Big Lebowski. Like I was about, 200 yards into Lebowski Fest before I realized that I was at a festival. they have like screenings and like I didn't do any of the events. I just kind of weirdly happened to be there at the time. I had seen The Big Lebowski, but I had only seen it once. And like my first thought was like, I should get out of here before somebody calls me a poser. Because like I don't like if somebody was like, do a quote from The Big Lebowski, I would have probably been like, oh, cowboy at the beginning.
So why,
I would have just said that.
So here's this thing. There are movies that are not successful financially in the box office. Rocky Horror Picture Show, Beastmaster, Army of Darkness, Clerks.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
And then you get movies like Big Lebowski that turn into what are coined cult films. Who wants to dive into the area of cult films and why they're important and what do they say and how, you know, is there something there them so something that people just are dying to see again and again and again? Matthew?
Mr. Cutter, pick me. That's a 70s reference, Zachary.
I don't believe
that's Horshack. May I go?
I called on you.
I will kill you with a stick. Oh, okay, cool. For me, we have discussed many times on this podcast and the Major Spoilers podcast a growing trend, probably over the last 50 years of filmmaking, to really target your movie to the largest possible audience. And right. What that means is they sand off all the rough edges. They make sure that there's nothing objectionable, nothing too strange, nothing bizarre, nothing out of the baseline, quote unquote, normal experience, so that the most people get in those first 2 weeks, get out, and don't ever have to watch the film again. And I think to define a cult film is, well, let's be frank here, that way lies madness.
Well, yeah, because I mean,
but
if you look at
any of the cult,
if you look at it, films like The Wizard of Oz, Lord of the Rings, Back to the Future are all cult classics as well.
Could be. But I think what you really find with a cult film is
you mean the rotoscope Lord of the Rings stuff?
No. I'm talking about the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, so
the Peter Jackson stuff.
You can have a cult classic that shatters like the box office.
It is called a cult blockbuster film, is this subgenre. Star Wars, The Matrix also fall into these categories.
Interesting. I would like my section of this to be me arguing against that classification.
Go ahead. This is Matt Hill's concept.
If Matthew, who's coming? Matthew's done.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matthew. Go ahead and finish up on your.
All right, but I think what you find with a film specifically like The Big Lebowski is, it is a film that has a specific perspective and personality. And when you get down to it, you know, we discussed, it's like A Couple of Days with the Dude. It's the kind of film that is pleasant enough to sit and watch, to where you might watch it again because it made you laugh, or it made you feel funny, or you enjoyed Walter flipping out. The film has such a specific experience tied to it that you watch this film to relive the experience. Same with Rocky Horror. Not a good movie.
Right.
But the experience of watching it is such that you want to do that again. One of my favorite movies is a cult movie, Night of the Living Dead. That movie is five people in a house yelling at each other, surrounded by some guys who are sleepwalking, and then some really, really impressively disgusting set pieces involving the ghouls.
Right.
And it's a movie that you get to the end of Night of the Living Dead, and there's literally a part of the movie where they ran out of money and Romero couldn't afford film. So the movie ends with a series of still shots.
Yeah, stills. Yeah.
And it's really, really awesome what they put together. And the tension, the feeling of watching that film is something that I want, at least, to feel over and over again. Even if I can, you know, quote back and forth the Beastmaster. You want to experience the Beastmaster again because the movie is made with such a specific perspective and such an expectation that you can buy into it. You can add your own little interpretations and expectations.
Right.
You can feel like you're the dude's friend.
Right.
I'm one of the dude's pals. I'm the one that they don't talk to. They never say, shut the F up, Matthew. But they could. And Walter might stick a gun in my face because I accidentally parked in his space or something.
You tried to mark it a 9, I mean, when it was really a 7, so that's the problem. So when we look at cult films, there's a couple of different types, classifications that we can go into. We can go into the so bad it's good, the Z movies, you know, the Plan 9 from Outer Space type stuff, camp and guilty pleasure movies, like maybe like The Big Lebowski might follow into that, although it really falls into this next category.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. But it does. Lebowski falls into the third category, the midnight movies category. The ones that you can show at a midnight feature and people will show up. In fact, that's how they figured out that Lebowski was more popular than they originally thought, because somebody opened it up at a weekend midnight showing and they had to turn away like 600 people. And then it ran midnight every weekend for 6 weeks, and they were still drawing people in. Rocky Horror Picture Show falls under the midnight movies. You've got the art exploitation and genre films. that fall into this. You have animation, and then this is why I think movies like Back to the Future and Star Wars fall in here. There's this nostalgia, as Matthew just mentioned. There's a nostalgia for a lot of these movies that you remember as a kid, and you'll go and sit down and watch them again and again and again. For me, you know, a guilty pleasure film is now I forgot it. It's the battling space bugs. Paul Verhoeven, Starship Troopers. Yeah, I love that movie. And we would, and every, when I was living in California, me and a coworker and a bunch of his friends, like probably every other weekend, would go over to his house. We'd pop in three movies: Army of Darkness, Starship Troopers, and then some kung fu movie. And we would just get drunk and have fun and yell at the screen and shout all the quotes from all the movies. And it was fun. It was that experience of what we were doing, but we knew that these movies weren't great, but they're those guilty pleasures. There's a lot of fun inside of that. But Lebowski became really popular because of these midnight showings in that. Do you have a, Matthew, you already mentioned yours. Rodrigo, do you have a cult film that is one of your favorites?
I think like a sizable amount of the movies I like are cult movies. Like I said, I mentioned Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Those don't necessarily get put in the Criterion Collection. I like, you know, like I'm a big fan of like something like Pan's Labyrinth, which, you know, did okay and was successful, but it's not something that somebody pops in all the time. You know, Scott Pilgrim is rapidly on its way to becoming a cult classic because it didn't do that well. But it has a strong following, especially for people that come to it through the comic.
That's kind of a modern example of that midnight thing where they show that thing at midnight. I'm seeing postings of them showing that all the time at midnight in cities and Los Angeles, and it's they're shown at midnight all the time.
Yeah. So what does that say about our culture then? I mean, you know, what does it say about our society or about our culture? Is there a need for cult films?
Well, absolutely. I think like Matthew pointed out, the movies that tend to do well are very produced. And there's basically this, like getting a successful film is kind of a game of like Venn diagrams.
Right.
It's like if you can get this demographic, and this demographic to like your movie, it'll be monetarily successful. Right. If you get, you know, comic book nerds and non-comic book nerds who like spy thrillers, and you get like big action people, and you get all those together, Captain America: The Winter Soldier is a successful movie, right?
Right.
Plus the Marvel fans and all that. Like, again, when you start lining up all those Venn diagrams, there are other Venn diagrams that aren't that successful, but they still exist. You know, it's like when you get like stoners and, you know, people who you get like stoners, slackers, people who like Coen Brother movies, people who love John Goodman. You get all of those together, you get, you know, the Big Lebowski crew. And those people are going to continue spending money on the Big Lebowski, and will, you know, slowly trickle back to the filmmakers, hopefully, if their contracts were proper. And they will be rewarded for that over time. And really that's what a lot of cult movies become, is that, you know, over a period of 20 years, a movie will continue to make money for the studio and for the filmmakers, and will eventually pay for itself. But it takes a lot longer than the big blockbusters.
If you look at things like, you look at Rocky Horror, Rocky Horror, for whoever is, you know, collecting the money, and it could be hundreds of people, Rocky Horror has made millions of dollars in the years that it's been out. And you have to figure that that's an incredibly successful film. But when you say, do we need cult films? I say yes. And the reason why is because I'm a big fat nerd. And when I was growing up, the nerd experiences that I shared with my fellow nerds that shaped me were things like, have you seen this Akira movie?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this heavy metal movie? Oh, wait, my friend Josh had a copy of Head, the Monkees movie, on VHS. And he's like, you got to see this. This is incredible. Those are formative experiences. And those are the shared experiences. You know, the equivalent of my grandmother. She used to we would go on car trips and I would ride with my grandmother, and she used to sing all the songs that she sang with her family when she was a kid, just sitting around the living room because there was no electricity and no television in 1924.
Mm-hmm.
That was a shared experience. And as our culture becomes so much of a vicarious one, where we don't necessarily connect with each other through specific experiences, but through the things that we consume, the things that we enjoy, the things that we consider ourselves to be a member of, to belong to. Those shared experiences, especially cult movies, which are smaller, kind of smaller sample sizes, actually become more important.
Yeah.
Because if you can say to somebody, and this is dangerous because, as we've seen with the comic industry, thinking that there's a magic password leads to some serious dickhead behavior. Mm-hmm. But knowing that if you meet somebody and that guy's like, dude, have you seen that movie, Heavy Metal? You can go, oh, my God, that's 80 minutes of the most embarrassingly awesome stuff ever. And you have that moment where you're like, yes, we have a shared
experience. Right, that shared experience. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're ultimately going for. I think the other thing, though, Zach, is that you never know what is going to make.
Sure.
You know, you could take all of the Venn diagrams and line them up and you could say, well, this is going to be the perfect cult movie, but you're never going to have somebody make that. Yeah. Cult movies are made by accident.
And when they try to make a cult movie.
Yeah, they just fly.
So they try to make a cult movie like what is that one with Kim Basinger where she is the cartoon?
Cool World.
When they try to make a cult movie, I feel like some of the authenticity is lost and the audience will look at that and go, no, your cult movie is not a real cult movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same kind
of
idea.
And some of them are inexplicable.
Yeah. Marketing teams would be like, make a viral video.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you've never been on the internet, I guess.
Yes. You don't understand it. It just happens.
Yeah. And I mean,
that's a good point. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, would you ever go into a project, you want to say, I want to make a cult movie. Is that any like
I don't know. I'm sure it's been said by somebody that
sure.
This is going to be a cult classic.
But are like, any of the cult classics that they went into this is going to make money in
maybe 14 if you're broken
years?
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
That's
yeah.
the thing. I mean, if got certain people can do that. I think Monty Python and Broken Lizard and to some degree Mike Judge can go in and say, I expect my movie to be a cult classic because, frankly, there aren't enough people who are going to go see my movie in the theater to turn it into a real movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that you can go out, and even if you're Mike Judge or John Cleese or, God help you, Jay Chandrasekhar, you can't say my next movie is going to be a cult classic.
No.
You just make a movie.
Right. You just make a movie.
That matters to you. And then you make a movie that matters to you. People respond.
Yeah. Well, and that is what ends up happening, right? Is like this movie is made with an aesthetic or I don't know, an ethos that is different from your standard major Hollywood picture. So some people, even if there's going to be people out there who will simply reject it because it doesn't look like what they're familiar with. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big reason why you don't have that many, like why that definition is just kind of like a movie that not everyone likes, but people like very fervently.
Mm-hmm.
And you just like that. That's what ends up happening is just you have people that have a similar life experience or a similar aesthetic eye or something like that, something that's similar to the filmmaker, to what the filmmakers are putting forward. And those people latch onto that movie and they latch onto it extra hard because they don't have that many movies that are like that. There's not that many movies that they will that express that. I don't know.
Well, it's
like, for example, one of my favorite movies is, yeah, one of my favorite movies is Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, mm-hmm. and that movie is insanely absurd. And the whole time, they just play it completely straight. At no point does anybody really look at the camera. Well, they do look at the camera to be like, Death doesn't want to, like, Death wants to keep playing Twister, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But there's no like winking or nudging or tongue in cheekness about it. Everything just kind of moves forward in this ridiculous plot. Like, it's a perfectly reasonable plot line.
Yeah. And like,
and I appreciate that. There's something about that that I really love.
Right.
Yeah.
And I will, like, it's gotten me, it's practically gotten me into fights because people will tell me that it's not a good movie. And there's a lot of reasons why I think it's a good movie. So it makes you a little bit more fervent, more likely to go spread the word about it, because you know that out of 10 people that you tell, none of them are going to want to watch it unless they're dating you, and then you kind of make.
Then you have to.
But like a cult, you will do anything in your power to make sure that you spread the good word of Station and Evil Robot Bill and Ted.
That's right.
And when you latch onto a cult film, you know, whatever that may be, if it's the Big Lebowski for you, or Army of Darkness, or Starship Troopers, or whatever it is, if there's a movie that comes along that is in that same vein, even though it's not intended to be, oh, well, this is another version of Big Lebowski, it'll be a big hit with the people, even if it's not the intention, people will reject that movie, even if it is the same similar type thing, which is really interesting too.
Yeah, you can't force that sort of zeitgeist. You can't push it. And for me, the best cult movies, like The Big Lebowski, have a reality that may or may not be serious, but they play it entirely straight. Big Lebowski doesn't point and laugh at the dude for being so lazy. It doesn't call out Walter for, you know, being such a jerk or for having his problems. You know, it allows Walter to tell one of his best friends, shut the F up, Donnie, every 5 seconds. It allows the dude to be hapless and feckless and stupid. You know, if you look at The Warriors, which is another wonderful movie, classic movie for me, cult movie, everybody in that film is, by today's standards, suspect, because they are street gang members who basically participate in illegal activities. But as you watch that film and you see what they do, you see Swan being Swan and having his Swan moment. And you have these moments where these characters are given their own reality. Everybody in that film has something going on that is kind of, for them at least, an authentic experience. When they meet Mercy, the girl, and she's making fun of them because they're with the wrong gang, but it turns out that they're actually more powerful than her brother, who's in the crappy gang, and they have the quick rumble, and then seven warriors beat up 35 orphans or whatever it is. It's a moment where you should be going, oh, this is terrible. This is crime in the streets, and these teenagers are beating each other senseless. But no, you think, yes, Swan, get on the train, go home, run, Swan, run,
and save the rec center.
You feel for those characters.
Oh, different movie.
This is what happens when you fight a stranger in the Alps, Steven. This is what happens.
Who made our discussion of cult films possible today?
Those would be our associate producers. Who would be? Christian Fisher, David Marble, Ethan Guberman, Julia Hess, Christopher Dolly, Nathan Denny, Linscog Severine, Paul Fassett, Josh Payne, Daniel Auger, Robert Kaslick, Stephen Probst, Alexander Deichen, Amber Dennett, and William Gibson. Thank you, one and all, our associate producers, for making this podcast possible and so many more.
And if you want to be an associate producer, head over to members.majorspoilers.com. Sign up for one of those membership levels. Gold gets you your name shouted out on this show and many others. But there's also bronze and silver memberships if you want to just do like $2 a month, which really isn't a lot. That's like 25 cents. We do 10 podcasts a week on average. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. But even if we did 8 a week, that's less than 25 cents an episode for everything that we do, which means that if you do that 4 times
a
week,
$2 a day.
That's like 8 times 4 is 32 divided by 2 divided into 2 is how much? It's like 10 cents an episode almost.
16
cents an episode, ladies and gentlemen. For just 16 cents a day, we can afford to send Zach to
we can feed somewhere. Little Zach.
We can feed young Zach.
And get him much.
Oh, you know what we could do with your 16 cents a day? You know what we could do with your 16 cents a day? White Russians for everyone. What's 5 that? Parts vodka. Two parts Kahlua or coffee liqueur, and 3 parts fresh cream. So pour the liqueur and the vodka into an old-fashioned glass over ice, and then pour that cream on top and stir slowly. There is your recipe for a white Russian. Zach, what did you get out of this movie?
All my glasses are old fashioned.
I got from technical side. I thought there was a lot of great shots, like that bowling shot.
When
Lebowski gets knocked out, things get kind of weird and fairly interesting. So the bowling shot is interesting, and I've been thinking for a long time how they did
CG bowling ball over a shot of a camera on a rotisserie spit kind of thing.
Yeah. That's what I figured. So that was a cool shot, and I like that one a lot. And that weird musical number.
Yeah.
The infinite staircase and like the forever tall
Buzzfeed
thing.
Berkeley musical reference. Yeah.
Those were cool shots. And
they're nice.
I mean, it was just throwing people through like different styles into a film.
Yeah.
Naturally is cool. Blocking a scene. I started watching the movie over again right before we recorded, and the first scene when you get in the bowling alley between the dude and Walter and Donnie, when they're talking about how horrible it is and what a grievance it is that his rug has been peed on.
Right.
And
really tie the room together.
Yeah. So I mean,
Asian American is the preferred nomenclature, Zach.
We start that scene on a shot of Donnie, who I'm going to say right now, I'm going to guess, I bet Donnie was the best bowler out of the three. I don't know why. I think Donnie was actually the best bowler.
Probably.
That's likely. That's possible.
Yeah. So we start on Donnie, and then we move the camera to a shot with all three of them as they just go on and be acting awesome people. And so everyone's divided into thirds there. The dude's on the left, Walter straight up middle, and Donnie's on the right sitting there about to mark a scorecard. And everyone's perfectly framed, and there's just this really slight movement where Donnie leans forward to mark his score while those two are still arguing, completely ignoring the success of Donnie, always.
Right.
And the camera just follows it a bit, and they keep the thirds still. Donnie slides back into where he was, and the camera slides back with him. It's very quick and it's very subtle, but it's a nice move to keep the thirds intact. And then eventually it's the time of the dude to bowl. The dude walks out of frame and the camera follows him, and then it still keeps the thirds by putting Donnie in the left, Walter in the middle, and then I guess it'd be like the ball return machine or whatever console was for the bowling thing. Right. Still keeping that. And so that was just a wonderful executed scene, I thought.
Cool. So what are you going to take with you besides just blocking? Blocking is the main thing?
Yeah, blocking was a big thing, I think, and just camera position.
Okay. Excellent.
And using the title to foreshadow the big hook. I think the big Lebowski in the movie is the turn.
Yeah. All right, Zach, I think you did a great job, obviously, very much at the very beginning of the show where you've came up with a different take than what maybe other people have done. So good job on that. Rodrigo, Matthew, anything else you want to add? I guess not. So, ladies and gentlemen.
David Huddleston is pretty awesome.
Ladies and gentlemen, we only have 25 movies left on this list.
Oh, no.
Which means something's going to have to happen with Zach on film once we hit the end of that 25.
Yeah.
So we're going to let you use the comment section to let you decide what happens next. But Zach, why don't you take us out of here?
All right. That's the end of this episode. As we talk to Big Lebowski on Zach on Film, make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com where you can give all of your thoughts and ideas about the Big Lebowski or what you would like to see for the future of Zach on Film. While you're at majorspoilers.com, make sure to click on that amazon.com link where you can go buy your own very own copy of The Big Lebowski or any other films featured here on Zach on Film. It's not going to cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to us. And next week, we will be talking Bonnie and Clyde on Zach on Film.